of Christmases Long, Long Ago is my new book, arriving for the 2025 Christmas season. Find out what Christmas was like centuries ago. Sneak preview, it was weird, and spooky, and rowdy, kind of gross sometimes. Find it wherever books are sold, in hardcover from Lions Press, and audiobook from Recorded Books. It's Christmas as you've never seen it before, and it makes a great gift. I'm Brian Earle. This is Christmas Past. The match was struck in Sarajevo, but the tinder had been piling up for years. Treaties, tensions, ambitions. When Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria-Hungary was assassinated in June of 1914, alliances snapped into place like trap springs. Austria blamed Serbia. Russia backed Serbia. Germany pledged itself to Austria, France to Russia. Then Germany swept through neutral Belgium to reach France, and Britain, bound by treaty, stepped in. The machinery of war roared to life. And what might have been a regional quarrel became a continental conflict, then a world war, though they wouldn't call it that for some time. The war that would end all wars had begun. In the beginning, it didn't feel like the end of the world. Young men sang songs on their way to the front, waving from train cars. Uniforms were pressed, boots polished. The war, they were told, would be over by Christmas. It would be a quick campaign, a grand adventure, a test of courage, and a chance to come home a hero. But by December, the mud had swallowed their boots, the songs had thinned into silence, and the adventure had turned to waiting. Waiting for the next shell, the next order, the next letter from home. The trenches hadn't been part of the plan. When the war broke out, leaders on both sides still believed in the old rules of warfare. Rapid cavalry charges, swift infantry advances, decisive battles settled in days. But those old rules were written in a world where the machine gun hadn't been invented yet. Those old rules met the harsh reality of 20th century warfare. So by the end of autumn, the fighting had stalled. Neither side could outflank the other, and so they dug in. First shallow scrapes in the earth for protection, then deeper in more elaborate systems. The trenches crept across the map like stitches on a wound, from the Swiss border to the North Sea. The conditions, of course, were miserable. The weather was another enemy, one that neither side could fight back against. Trenches were cold, filthy, flooding was constant, the mud sometimes knee-deep. It was nearly impossible to ward off trench foot or frostbite. Day after day, soldiers ate the same tinned beef and dried bread, which was difficult to store away from the mud and the rats. The shelling was endless, and so was the waiting. Men crouched shivering in trenches with rotting feet and frazzled nerves in a game of high-stakes boredom. One moment silence, the next terror and bloodshed, and then quiet again, and then more cold and rain. December came, and the war would not be over by Christmas after all. For many of the men, it was the first Christmas they'd ever spent away from home. Spending it in trenches where the rain was now constant, where the enemy was sometimes as close to 100 feet across a no-man's land littered with bodies and debris. Calls for peace rang out across the world. America, which hadn't joined the war yet, issued a joint congressional resolution that a Christmas truce be observed, lasting 20 days. Pope Benedict XV, newly elected that fall, had called for a truce for the holiday, that the guns may fall silent, at least upon the night the angels sang. Every request was rejected. Officially, the war would continue. And yet, something was happening in the trenches. Both the British and the German high commands had sent care packages, chocolates, pipes, mittens, cigars. Families sent parcels too, more than the men could make use of or even find a dry place to store. Soldiers began swapping items. What they had too much of, they passed around. It was beginning to look a little something, like Christmas in the trenches. A few German units, particularly Saxon regiments, put up small Christmas trees on the parapets of their trenches, topping them with candles, trimming them with bits of ribbon or cigar bands. British and French troops hung up scraps of evergreen. A French regiment reportedly staged a vaudeville review in a sheltered barn. Somewhere, a soldier with a clear tenor sang from the Messiah. On Christmas Eve, the rain stopped. The mud froze over, making the ground traversable, a small blessing, all things considered. And that night, voices drifted up from the trenches. Most accounts suggest that it started with the singing. From the German side, Stille Nacht, Heilige Nacht. From the British side, the First Noel. Carols carried over the wire. Cheers followed, then silence, then more songs. The next morning, Christmas morning, some soldiers stood up on the parapets, slowly, carefully. Normally, doing so meant death. But this time, there were no shots. They waved, and across the line, the enemy waved back. In some sectors, soldiers ventured into no man's land. They exchanged gifts, cigarettes, buttons, badges, chocolates. Some traded helmets for caps. A few played makeshift soccer on the frozen ground. A pig was roasted. One British soldier had his hair cut by a German barber he'd known from before the war. They buried the dead. That was the real beginning of this unofficial truce in most places. Between the trenches lay bodies of men who had fallen weeks before, beyond the reach of stretcher bearers or prayers. Now, unarmed men from both sides worked together to gather them. They dug shallow graves. They shared a moment of silence, and then a hymn. The Christmas truce was not universal. Along some stretches of the line, the fighting never paused. In others, soldiers who tried to cross the line were shot. But the phenomenon, whatever you call it, was widespread. An estimated 100,000 men, about two-thirds of all troops, took part in it. Some held their peace for a few hours, others for days. In the days following, back in Britain, letters from the front began to arrive home. Stunned recipients of these letters shared them with newspapers which published the accounts.
Soldiers shared cigars and cigarettes and sang songs together in no man's land and organized a football match before returning to shooting each other.
I am writing this in the trenches. It is 11 o'clock in the morning. Beside me is a Coke fire. I'm smoking a pipe, the pipe of peace. A live German soldier is beside me, smoking a pipe of peace too.
The public read all of this with disbelief, and then wonder, and then pride. It was proof of something. But what? What was it? What was it really? In the 100 years since, the event has been seen as a kind of miracle, a rare moment of peace just a few months into a war that would eventually claim over 15 million lives. Some say it was Christmas, pure and simple, that the spirit of the season had slipped past the barbed wire and taken hold in the cold, wet hearts of exhausted men, that for one day, peace on earth and goodwill toward men wasn't just a prayer, it was real. Others argue that it was just practical, a chance to take a day off or several to reset and reclaim a bit of sanity. In most cases, the first and only goal was to retrieve the corpses. It almost certainly wasn't spontaneous, or even unusual. Small armistices were happening all the time. Even the routine pauses for mealtime were mini ceasefires themselves. In a war that had already descended into absurdity, maybe an impromptu truce was just one more quiet rebellion, when the men on the ground decided that they were not fighting the same war as their superiors. The war belonged to the generals, but the peace, however brief, belonged to the men. Some historians have tried to pin it down, to chart it, to draw a clean line from one trench to another. But the truth is, no one really knows where it started, or how, or why. Maybe it began everywhere all at once. Maybe it had been building for weeks. Maybe the silence of the night made it possible. But whatever the how and the why, the high command was not amused. They hadn't been amused for some time. On both sides of the line, military leaders had grown increasingly anxious about the spirit of camaraderie that sometimes flickered to life between enemy trenches. The nearness of trench warfare made it hard to dehumanize the other side. Officers had been encouraged for months to discourage any unmilitary behavior. British troops were warned not to grow too comfortable with the enemy across the wire. German generals circulated orders condemning informal truces, even temporary ones, as threats to morale and discipline. Fraternization, they feared, might erode the will to fight. And it had started to. Not in grand gestures, but in small ones. In ceasefires to collect the wounded. In shouted warnings before artillery fire. In gifts tossed across the void. The Christmas truce was just the most visible eruption of something already simmering. An instinct not to kill the man who laughed like you, who coughed like you, who waited in the cold like you. That instinct was dangerous to the war effort. Soon after, orders were issued forbidding any further fraternization. The war resumed. On December 26th, St. Stephen's Day, the guns began again. And they would not fall silent for another 4 years. But something stayed behind in the soil. A memory, a myth, a song passed from trench to trench. Even when the world fell apart, someone lit a candle. Someone sang. Someone stood up and waved. For just a moment, a silent night. So much has been written about what has become known as the Christmas Truce. Books, a movie, a stage play. Here in the Bay Area, I serve on the board of directors for a theater company that staged a production of the play Truce in 2024. When I was researching for this episode, I had a grand old time reading through historical newspaper articles reporting on the ceasefires and sharing soldiers' firsthand accounts. A special collection of those articles is available through the Library of Congress. Check the show notes for a link if you're curious to dig in deeper yourself. Well, there's not much deeper we can dig into this Christmas season because, sorry to say, it's starting to wind down. But stay with me all the way till Christmas Day for more stories like this one, our annual Christmas in Review episode, and more of your Christmas memories. I'm planning one more memories episode this season, and I want to include you in it, and there's still time if you hurry. All you have to do is record yourself speaking into your phone's voice memo app and send it to christmaspastpodcast@gmail.com. Keep it reasonably short, clean, and family-friendly, and be sure to say your name and where you're from. Christmas Past is produced in wonderful Willow Glen, California, by yours truly, Brian Earle. Thank you to Finbar Snary and Amin Daher for narrating those soldiers' letters. Finbar is host of the podcast Tarot Interviews. Check this episode's show notes to learn more about that. And as always, thank you for listening. You can drop me a line anytime. I always love to hear from you, and I try to respond to every message I get. You can send me an email or connect with me on your favorite social media platform. If you don't see me there and you think I ought to be, get in touch and let me know. And hey, if you're really feeling the Christmas spirit, why not help more people discover the show? It's as simple as telling a friend about it or leaving a rating and review. If you do leave a review, I'll send you a Christmas Past sticker, and a handwritten Christmas card is my way of saying thanks. Reach out for details, and until we meet again, may your days be merry and bright.